This episode of Bitch Propaganda was recorded on Thursday, April 1st at the Bitch headquarters in Portland, Oregon. Just a word of warning, the following podcast contains language that may be considered questionable, including the word bitch, of course. Also, as always, please excuse our background noise. We're saving up for that sound recording studio someday, but we're not quite there yet. Enjoy the podcast. All right, welcome back to another episode of Bitch Propaganda. It's like The View, but we don't have free copies of The Blind Side on DVD to give you, and even if we did, we probably wouldn't give them to you. I'm Kelsey Wallace, the web editor at Bitch, and with me today are...
Shamnia Graham, editorial intern.
And Sherston Johnson with a cold web content manager.
And we are going to be talking about a variety of exciting topics today. We'll start with Jacqueline Friedman's interview on Amanda Hess's The Sexist for Washington City Paper, Fucking While Feminist, and What is Your Feminist Litmus Test When You're Deciding Who to Have Intercourse With. We'll also be talking about the purchase of Venusine by a not-so-feminist-friendly woman who wants to change the direction of the publication, and then we'll be talking about Leslie Knope and Liz Lemon and how we think they compare and contrast to each other and which one we prefer. So let's go ahead and get started with the Washington City Paper interview. Jacqueline Friedman, who is the editor of Yes Means Yes and also the director of Wham, gave an interview with Amanda Hess about kind of sexual norms and kind of, she calls it her feminist litmus test, basically how it goes for her being a very open and ardent feminist and trying to date men. So I didn't know if, first of all, we wanted to start with, you know, what do you think of the idea of having a feminist litmus test for deciding who you're going to date?
Well, I think for me, it's just sort of inherent where eventually being in a relationship, issues that feminists deal with all the time, like feelings, positive or negative feelings about sex, valuing women's pleasure and bodies, like that just comes up while you date, and for me there's little litmus testing where I just feel like those things arise and you work them out eventually, that it's a more organic thing. But then again, conversation's a whole different topic.
I like the idea that you have to negotiate your politics and way of living when you're, you know, meeting potential partners and potential people that you would like to have sex with. But I don't necessarily feel that a lot of the compromises that Friedman perhaps suggests making or hints at having made in the past are all that different from the compromises that people generally make when they start dating to begin with anyways. I think it's, why is it worth overlooking somebody who may be slightly anti-feminist in a viewpoint, a behavior, an action, but then not excusing somebody's racist behavior.
Right.
And I feel that there are numerous viewpoints and strong positions that people hold, especially ways of living, and to suggest that being with somebody for a significant period of time or having this be-all, end-all relationship that makes that worth negotiating is somewhat problematic.
I think also, I mean, you know, there, it just kind of comes down to, like, as a feminist who works for a magazine called Bitch, I mean, and Jacqueline kind of says she's kind of experienced some of this too. I mean, she talks a little bit about meeting people online, but, I mean, there's already, if you kind of put it out there at the beginning...
Like, if someone asked Jacqueline Friedman, what do? She's like, I write about rape. Like,
then people who have kind of anti-feminist viewpoints or people who think that, like, rape isn't a problem in our culture are probably not going to date her. And she says, you know, she hasn't made it past the first date with some people because of that reason. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I personally have never had a dating situation where it didn't work out because of, like, feminist politics. But I've also, I mean, I just don't even think
date
that
people.
I would date someone who wasn't feminist. And they wouldn't want to date me either, you know?
Right.
And she talks a little bit about the idea of, like, turning someone feminist. And, I mean, I don't like the idea of, like, oh, I'm a feminist converter. But I do think you know, there is a difference between how men and women sometimes choose to identify when it comes to feminism. And I mean, as somebody who's dated guys, like, it's, you know, I think sometimes I've had the conversation with them about how, like, you know, you can call yourself a feminist, like, it's not just for mm-hmm. women. Or, you know, when you have these ideas about kind of inclusivity and equality, like, that is feminism. Mm-hmm. You know, you might have a misperception about what it actually is. But that's different than dating somebody who's like, oh, actually, you know, either number one, I don't think there's a problem, or number two, I don't want to deal with it because, like, I'm a privileged guy and I don't want to think about it. You know, that's just probably not someone that I would want to have sex with anyway. Right. Like, it's not, yeah. like, a real turn-on to me.
Yeah. And that's funny because it's sort of like what Chamonix was saying, where it's like, yeah, as I feel like we don't usually interact, you know, in an intimate way with people who don't share those values with us. And it's sort of like bringing... opening up the feminist dialogue with them and expanding on it just in the same way that they would, you know, maybe someone who doesn't call himself a feminist would, like, tell you about, you know, their interests that you didn't know about and then open those with you, like...
You're into rock climbing? Movies. Tell me more about that.
Yeah. See, that would be another deal breaker for you.
You didn't even know you were a rock climber.
What, rock climbing? No, I don't want to go on a second date. That seems dangerous.
So, do you, like... do rock climbing stuff?
Yikes. Also, I'm a feminist. Another thing that kind of stood out to me here that I didn't know if anyone wanted to speak to was that she says that she has met guys who, she says, oh God, there is a type of feminist guy who is so eager to fall all over himself to be deferential to women and to prove his feminist bona fides when it's a, I think it's fides. Okay. And flagellate himself in front of you to the point that it really turns me off. And it makes me sad because politically these are the guys I should be sleeping with. You know what I'm talking about? Has anyone ever experienced, like, I mean, basically what she's saying is that, you know, in a certain way, there's a type of guy who's too feminist for her to want to have sex with him.
And I mean, there's certainly the argument that she's allowed to have sex with whoever she wants. So if they're too feminist for her and she's not sexually attracted to these men, that's her deal and that's cool. But I think to conflate somebody being too feminist with their gender performance and then also their general unattractiveness in the eyes of other, perhaps, heterosexual female feminists is a little bit tricky.
I think it kind of speaks to, and she and Amanda Hess kind of talk about this too, I mean, the fact that I think we hate to admit it as feminists, but that there is a certain amount of kind of expectations that we have that are related to gender norms. And when we're talking about somebody who doesn't conform to the masculinity that we've kind of been socialized to be attracted to, it sucks to have to admit that, like, I'm sorry, but I kind of wanted you to be, like, a little bit more dudely or something. Right. Like, I'm not that into that, you know? And I get, I mean, she's saying, you know, she feels guilty because she wishes she was more into those guys. Mm-hmm. And I think that's understandable. And then on the other hand, of course, there is such a thing as taking the tenets of feminism and just taking them too far. I mean, when she's talking about somebody being totally deferential and, I mean, basically, if she makes a sex joke, he'll be so kind of horrified on her behalf because it's offended, you know, because it's offensive. And it's like, well, if you're going to be in a relationship with someone, you've got to have some wiggle room mm-hmm. for what you can say. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just think, as a feminist, I still want to be able to make inappropriate jokes with the person I'm dating. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they're probably not going to want to be with me mm-hmm. either. You know, it's not going to last that long.
I had a friend who put it, like, in the way that she saw that. She knew a guy who did that, and she sort of chalked it up to extreme white male guilt. Like, there was something else going on there that it wasn't just, like, too much feminism, but that person was dealing with, like, their own
privilege is getting to them.
Yeah, and so they had to work through that themselves, and then they could talk.
I wonder if this goes back to what Sherson was saying about discovering things during the natural course of a relationship and whether or not the personal and political aspects of feminism are the kinds of things that are just hard to negotiate on a first, second, third, fourth date, and if it really does take the intricacies of a relationship to kind of flush that out. And I mean, it's one of maybe the pitfalls of dating while feminist is that you really can't know what's going on sometimes, and maybe people that would be suited to you in the long run are just kind of thrown by the wayside if these litmus tests aren't really passed.
I will say too that another thing that kind of stood out to me that I wanted to talk about before we moved on is that she also says that, like, oh, you know, sometimes I think being a feminist is like a real bonus because some people are kind of clued in to the fact that sex with feminists is like super awesome because feminists are really kind of whatever, like more in touch with kind of what they want. And sometimes I feel like as a self-identified feminist, that's like setting me up with a false expectation. Like, guess what?
Maybe where are your chains, Kelsey?
Right, like maybe I'm not as like edgy and awesome between the sheets as you think I'm gonna be.
But I think that's fine because I had another friend and I'm not just doing the whole my friend and talking about myself.
She's talking about herself.
I promise.
My friend.
Who says like that was a problem with her and like, because that's a false expectation. Like all feminists aren't the same way. They're not all like the same way in the sheets. And she did feel like a guy had like these weird expectations for her to be like a notch on his belt. Like, oh, I was with like this feminist. And then like once they broke up, he was back to like, you know, non-feminist. And it was clear that was never the thing. So I don't think you should feel that way because it's that's another like false assumption.
But it's like I want people to want to have sex with feminists. I right. like the idea that it's like, oh, getting laid by a feminist is so awesome. That's great. But then, you know, it's like, yeah, do you think I'm going to bring some kind of like kinky
secret? This is my other feminist friend.
Yeah, exactly. Some secret thing you've never heard of that like only feminists can unlock the magic of this like bizarre sex practice, right. You know.
We take classes.
Right. It's like, guess what? It's probably going to be not that different with sex you've had with other people, except I might, like, complain about it afterwards.
I think it's interesting, too, that she brings up another expectation is that this, of this Hellcat dream girl. And I've certainly had experience with that where people think I'm interesting because I'm slightly aggressive. People think I'm interesting because I have an opinion. My male friends like to be like, yeah, Shamni's just like one of us. She's a total dude. And it's like, no, not really. I just talk. So I think this kind of expectation that feminists are these sassy women that really will bring this added pleasure to your life, once again, is a nice thought in actuality, but it kind of comes off in that same feminists are problems, feminists are...
Right, or like, oh, I mean, she compares it to the manic pixie dream girl archetype of like, oh, well, this is another kind, this like Hellcat dream girl that's gonna like put you in your place and be really like smart and sassy and just like kick a lot of ass. And it's like, yeah,
she's
okay.
40 all the time.
Exactly.
When you're 40 and married to somebody else, you can talk about how in college you dated a feminist.
Right.
She really helped me out with getting to know myself.
She really just dropped a lot of truth bombs in my face and changed my views. Well, let's segue right into our next topic, which is Venusine was purchased by Sarah Beardsley just this past week, I believe, or at least this past week. On the 25th was when the news came out about it. If you're not familiar, Venusine is a magazine that focuses mainly on women in music and the arts and has been a self-proclaimed feminist publication since it was founded in 1995 by Amy Schrader.
And like Bustin' Bitch, it started as a handmade zine kind of thing and has grown to like a larger distributed magazine.
Right. And the new owner, Sarah Beardsley, says that she wants to remove feminism from the mission statement of the magazine because she just doesn't think it's relevant. And she's one of those people that get under my skin right away.
She said old-fashioned.
Yeah, that say that the F word just isn't something we like to use around here, you know. And basically, like, feminism is so over, and we're just, like, fun-loving, music-loving ladies, and that's not our thing. And she wants to increase their circulation from 60,000, which, full disclosure, is about the exact same size of Bitch, and they're quarterly, just like us, to 200,000. And so, of course, we've got kind of a vested interest because this is a similar magazine to ours. Mm-hmm. But also, I mean, I just think it's interesting, you know, I don't know, Shamini, if you want to start with just kind of how do you feel about this change? You know, what are your thoughts on taking feminism out of the mission statement?
Well, my main issue, I think, is with Beardsley's statements is that she does feel that the feminism aspect of Venus is what hindered the magazine, and hindered also kind of signals this certain value of success and what it means to be a successful publication and what exactly that entails. Mm-hmm. And for Beardsley, it's readership and now taking the quarterly magazine and trying to make it into a monthly, which is no easy undertaking to really do. But I think this idea that feminism is what hindered the magazine is kind of a a slap in the face to the loyal readers who have read the magazine for countless years, for the people that have toiled away at producing this publication, and to those people, the feminism aspect is what kept it going, not what really stopped
right,
it from
right.
exploding into the next Us Weekly.
Yeah, in the article, it has her, Beardsley, sort of like getting like fiercely defensive and being like, why is it anti-feminist to cover successful women? Like, is Venus supposed to stay the same way forever? And I think that's not the point because, you know, Bitch has changed over the years. We've introduced websites and podcasts and, like, I mean, that's just what publications have to do now is, like, really expand and change. But the problem is that she, yeah, like you were saying, she thinks feminism is what's been holding it back. And that she thinks by like, you know, focusing on celebrities, which, you know, this is absurd that we need more celebrity magazines and less feminist media, is what's holding it back. And that there aren't more outlets for the zine to thrive. And that it's this old fashioned notion that women are people that is holding the magazine back.
And I really don't like the false dichotomy of it's either that we're feminist and are therefore kind of super niche, or we lose the feminist label and are therefore able to like cover all these awesome women. It's like, why can't you keep the feminist label and still become a monthly publication that covers, you know, these women that you are saying have kind of not been covered in the magazine up until this point? And also, hello, Venus Dean has been covering awesome women for the past 15 years.
Yeah.
So this isn't really a new direction. I mean, the direction that I'm seeing based on the article is that they want to introduce more celebrities and take away kind of any sort of political leaning that the magazine might have had. And I don't know, to me it's just kind of a shame because for people who do care about feminism and getting, you know, their fix from like women fronted bands and women artists, and you know, our options are getting more limited. Yeah, the internet is great, but sometimes it's nice to be able to have a print magazine
right.
that has music reviews of bands that you actually might want to hear, you know? And, you know, if they're just going to be another magazine that's going to review the latest, like, Justin Bieber My World 2.0 album, I can get that somewhere else. I don't mm-hmm. need...
Right.
Yeah, Venus and, like, if you pick up Spin or Rolling Stone, it's just, like, yawn, and it's just... And it's not like Venus just covered... women artists. They were just like a great music magazine that you could pick up instead of these other ones that were just sort of like smarmy and dude-centered.
Oh, ads.
Yeah. And it was
oh, yeah,
like,
I'm sure they're going to increase their ads. They'll have to if they're going to go monthly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was just like really refreshing. And it's, yeah, like you said, it's just a shame, basically.
Now, I do kind of want to play devil's advocate here a little bit because we put this on our Facebook thread, our Facebook wall. And a lot of people actually commented and said, you know, I disagree that it's a problem that they're losing the feminism from the magazine because this is still going to be a great publication. And basically, you know, we're kind of hating on them because we're so fixated on the label that we can't see beyond the label and see that they're still going to be talking about awesome women. And it's basically they're going to be reaching a larger audience now. So this is something we should be happy about. Well, now, does anyone think there's credibility to that argument?
Yeah, I think there is credibility to that article, and I mean to that argument. But the thing is that in this, and I am basing this off of the Chicago Reader article. But I mean, the new owner of the magazine has made it clear that feminism, that she doesn't consider herself a feminist, and it's fine if you don't want to label the magazine that way. But if she says that, if she makes it clear that she doesn't see value in feminism right now, then I think that's where the problem is.
And I think. What Beardsley is trying to do is get rid of what she thinks is this antiquated notion of feminism, but I think what's actually happening is that she's operating from an antiquated notion of feminism where she's not actually looking at feminist politics, feminist movements, feminist theory, feminist music, feminist culture in general,
right.
and seeing its importance and prevalence in 2010, but rather deferring back to this 1970s stereotype of bra burning, non-leg shaving. I don't know.
Yeah, the fact that she doesn't see it relevant.
Today. Right, is based on her own kind of lack of engaging with feminism and not necessarily feminism's lack of importance or applicability in today's age.
Right, and I think, I mean, what is really kind of the trigger for me to feel upset about this is not that, oh, there's going to be this publication out there that's talking about, you know, pop culture and music, et cetera, that's not labeling themselves as feminist. It's that you're taking a publication that is already labeled as feminist and is one of only maybe like three or four out there that are doing this kind of stuff, and you're changing it and getting rid of that, and you're basically making it into like Jane version two, you mm-hmm. know, and we've seen that before. I just think it's too bad that we have to sacrifice what Venusine has been over the past 15 years to get this kind right. of homogenized, more boring product. Like, hello, just start your own different magazine if that's the direction that you want
right.
to take.
Why take an already established brand that is already meaningful to at least 60,000 people, if not more, and then try and build that readership to 200,000, but at the same time, you have to consider how much of that 60,000 is no longer going to read that magazine. Mm-hmm. Are you really building on an audience, or are you creating an entirely new one?
Hello, former Venusine readers. If you weren't already reading Bitch, you should start, because we're still going to cover that stuff.
Right.
We're still putting feminism right on the front, where it belongs.
The F word.
Yeah.
The B word.
We won't call it the F word here. We're proud. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's a good conversation starter, and I've been hearing lately people who are rejecting the label of feminism because they just feel like they don't want to identify as feminist. And I don't know. I mean, maybe...
Capital F feminism.
Right. It's like, maybe I'm the, you know, becoming like the old school feminist or something, but it's... I just want to be like, fuck you. Uh-huh. If you care about this, you know, these kind of politics, call yourself a feminist. The reason why we are getting a bad reputation is because people like you won't own up to being a feminist. And you have to, like, whisper that it's the F word. And then, like, you know, put the gossip on the cover of your magazine and say that you care about women-produced music, but right. you won't call yourself a feminist. Well, get out of here. Yeah.
One day there will be sixth-wave feminists, and they will not like us. We will not be hip anymore.
We will be the dinosaurs who were like, I used to work for this really cool magazine. And they're like, yeah,
bitch.
Grandma, that sounds really awesome.
Bitch, I work for cunt.
Totally. All right, well, I think that's as good of a time as any to segue into the Liz Lemon versus Leslie Knope debate that we've had around the office here. I mean, not to brag, but I think we're all pretty avid TV watchers. We've been talking about this since Parks and Rec kind of got started. But now we're in the position of having seen almost an entire season of Parks and Rec and 30 Rock kind of right next to each other. And so, you know, we get a chance every Thursday night to see Liz Lemon and Leslie Knope in very similar kind of vehicles in terms of format and even kind of some of the behind-the-scenes stuff on the shows of who's writing and who's producing. There's a lot of similarities between the two shows and a lot of crossover, and yet we see two different characters. And something that I think is interesting that makes a comparison useful is that they're two of the only characters that are currently on TV that I can think of that identify themselves as feminist as a character. I mean, it's not just like the writer saying that they have a feminist agenda. It's like the character within the context of the show is vocal about being a feminist. First of all, can you think of any other characters that are... I can't think, especially not on network TV.
No.
You know, there's some reality stuff that I can think of. There's some kind of more cable stuff. But in terms of network TV, and I don't watch everything on network TV, but other, you know, characters that we might want to identify themselves right. as feminists, like, say, oh, I don't know, Robin Scherbatsky on How I Met Your Mother or something. Mm-hmm. She's not vocal about feminist politics the way Liz Lemon and Leslie Knope both are. So, and also another kind of prompt for this is that Sadie Doyle, who we all love and think is an awesome blogger, has been talking about this a little bit, too, on Feminist the past couple of days and on her blog, Tiger Beatdown. So, let's get things started. First of all, we'll say Chamonix's Canadian, so she hasn't had a chance.
My bad.
She hasn't had a chance to be up on the shows, but she certainly knows who Tina Fey and Amy Poehler are. So
And to clarify, we do get these shows in Canada, so it's not Canada's fault.
It's Canada's fault.
My own fault for being disengaged.
But she can play
so
the kind of...
So it's Canada's fault.
Blame Canada.
So it's Canada. So Sherson and I will be sort of taking the lead here, and Chamonix will be providing the color commentary. So, Tristan, why don't you start? What do you think about Leslie Knope and Liz Lemon?
Well, definitely since Parks and Rec picked itself up and is now a very funny and engaging show in its second season, I've fallen off the 30 Rock parade float. Like, I am all about Parks and Rec. When I tune into 30 Rock, I'm just... There's, like, some good one-liners, but I am continually disappointed by Liz Lemon, who always, like, starts off as, like, oh, I've got it so rough, why can't I get ahead? But then always just falls back on, like, yeah, I actually really just do wish I had a boyfriend, and, like, everything would be better if I lived up to this expectation of a woman who's successful and pretty and eats the right things and has a happy family. And there's just not enough, like, believable irony in that anymore. And I just don't get into that. And meanwhile, on Parks and Rec, Leslie Knope is just, like, so chipper about, like, nothing gets her down. Like, even when, like, on a recent episode, she her boss, who's sort of, like, a mustachioed, straightforward, meat, breakfast-loving type of guy.
Ron Swanson.
Yeah. won, like, this award, like, the Woman of the Year award that Leslie's wanted since she was a little girl, which says something in itself about her character. And it turns out that it was all a publicity ploy. They wanted a man to win, and Leslie was sort of, like, faced with this problem of this institution, this organization that she had adored was, you know, just in it, was just sort of like another political branch. And she had to face that, and in the end, she, like, didn't lose her own drive. She was, like, a little disappointed with how the politics behind these organizations work, but she was still, like, out to get it, and she and her boss came out in the end, like, closer and learned a lesson about politics, but, you know, she was still just as ambitious as ever. And
she called them sexist jerks, which I think, again, I mean, I've got to give it up to Leslie Knope and Liz Lemon, too. I mean, I don't want this to be a Liz Lemon hate fest for, like, their characters really do call out sexism in the workplace. But, I mean, and we were talking a little bit about this before we started recording, Liz Lemon is coming from a lot more of a self-serving place where she calls out sexism when she's not necessarily getting what she wants or needs in the workplace. And that's sexism, too, or it can be, but I think what I like about Leslie Knope, and, you know, 2 years ago, I would have been really surprised to hear myself say anything bad about 30 Rock.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
But here we are. Like,
yeah, totally.
Sorry, 30 Rock. Now there's something to compare you to that is just as funny, if not funnier, at this point, and is not as mean-spirited. I mean, now when I watch 30 Rock, I just think, this is so nasty.
Yeah.
Like, this is so snarky. It's just, like, cold-hearted. I just
feel like, why do you all hate each other?
All the jokes are at someone's expense. Everybody's kind of backstabbing. You know, I think the Liz Lemon Jack Donaghy friendship is kind of the only relationship on the show that doesn't have a sort of hard edge. Like,
but it's still so weird. I'm like, why do you always defer to your jackass boss? And it's always like, wait, why do you still care what he thinks, or that you don't, like, trash him behind his back? And it's just, like,
and
really
he still makes cracks about your looks, and
yeah.
It's like, oh, also, P.S. Hello, Tina Fey is gorgeous. So this is not really resonating
based in reality at all.
And I really, you know, I love that on Parks and Rec they don't seem to stoop to that level that often. There was that Jerry episode that kind of bugged me, where it was all, like, jokes about the one, like, fat loser in their office.
And, like, Parks and Rec is not without its own problems. And it's not, like this shining beacon of a feminist TV.
But I actually think right now it is kind of a shining beacon of feminist TV based on what we've got to choose from.
Exactly. It shows how star feminists are for characters that actually reflect their lives and what's going on. And to compare the two shows, it just shows that, you know, 30 Rock doesn't really have the market cornered anymore. And needs to kind of step up its game to really be fulfilling to, I think, the audience that made the show in the first place.
Right. I mean, all these people who were so excited to see a multi-dimensional, nuanced, smart, funny female character like Liz Lemon are now also, you know, getting to watch Leslie Knope and seeing, like, oh, you know, here's somebody who actually, gasp, has women friends and spends time with other women and really supports, like, the idea of, you know, women succeeding in the workplace and in personal relationships, and she help set her friends up with dates, and, like, her friends set her up. And, I mean, it just kind of, you know, I don't know. I think it's just a lot more positive of a portrayal of, like, hey, guess what? Being a feminist doesn't mean that you're, like, a mean, nasty bitch. Sorry, because we like mean bitch. But, you know, it can also mean that, yeah, I mean, she's a little naive. I don't think that we want to all, like, turn ourselves into her.
There's, like, that one episode where she's on the soccer field, and she's like, why don't you let the girls' team practice? And the guy coach is like, I am coaching the girls. And the female coach is coaching the boys' team that won't leave the soccer field. And so it's, like, funny, because it does poke fun at it. She's not, like, yeah, she's clueless in a funny way.
Yeah, she's a little naive about, like, gay politics, too. I mean, there was a pretty funny episode where, but again, it's like, she's naive, but she seems really open-minded. And she, like, loved getting to go and help DJ at the gay club and, like, hang out with all these you know, the gay community that was supporting her for a decision she made politically. And I don't know. I mean, she just seems like she's got such a positive attitude. And I think what I really like, I mean, just kind of the bottom line, is that I think sometimes I convince myself that in order for a show to be, you know, funny and popular and also have any kind of feminist politics at all, it has to be really mean-spirited, that that kind of sarcasm and that kind of snark is, like, what needs to kind of disguise the feminism in order to sell it. And then it's like, oh, hello, actually, we can have something that is just as funny, just as entertaining, you know, pushes some of the same envelopes, and does not have that kind of backbiting nastiness.
Right.
But I think it's also interesting. I mean, of course, the comparison kind of is begged by the fact that, you know, Amy Poehler and Tina Fey are really good friends in real life.
Right.
And the shows are both, you know, written and produced by the main characters and are playing, like, on the same night on NBC. But I also wonder, do I feel like I have to compare the two of them because they're really all we've got in terms of self-proclaimed feminists on network television? And then is that kind of doing a disservice? Like, is it kind of like the Venusian argument where it's like, just don't, you know, don't trash Liz Lemon, just be glad that they're both on TV? I don't know. You know, is it necessary to have, like, a winner and a loser between the two of them?
Well, I think the easily comparable aspects of the shows, having the same format, having main stars that have close personal and working relationships with each other, and also having similar kind of production stuff going on, makes them comparable. But at the same time, I think if we had more options, we wouldn't necessarily be stuck on comparing the two. And also, with more options comes the need not to settle for television or entertainment that you find not satisfying on all the levels that you need to be satisfied on.
Right. Like, wouldn't it be awesome if right now we were doing a roundup of, like, all of the 10 right. self-proclaimed feminist characters on network TV?
Right.
And we could, you know, kind of take it to a different level of analysis because we had more to work with. Which right now, it's kind of like, oh, well, who would you rather be, Liz Lemon or Leslie Knope? Which, by the way, who would you rather be, Liz Lemon or Leslie Knope?
Based on their actual personalities of Tina Fey and Amy Poehler, I would rather be Tina Fey.
You can't base it on the actual personality.
I can because I've never seen the show.
Okay. She gets a pass.
Thank you, Canada.
I want to say Amy Poehler. I mean, sorry. Leslie Knope. I'm from the Midwest, for one. But, yeah, I just appreciate her positivity. Like, even, like, she's also been compared to Michael from The Office as, again, just, like, her blatant positivity in the face of what could be a very negative and, like, dull job, which was brought up on a recent episode. But, yeah, I just really appreciate that about her. And I think everyone in her office is awesome, so I'd love to work with them.
Yeah, I think I would, too. I will say about the Michael Scott comparison that Michael Scott really annoys me, and Leslie Knope doesn't.
Love-hate thing, though.
Like, if you are listening and have not seen Parks and Rec, I would say that that comparison is accurate in terms of, like, both of them being positive people. But The Office, again, it's like all of the jokes have to come at someone's expense. And right. What I like about the Leslie Knope character is that, sure, she's a little naive. Yeah, she's willing to make fun of herself, but she's not the butt of the jokes. And that's where I think Parks and Rec has really saved itself, because in season one, which was only a couple of episodes, that really was the angle. It was like, Leslie Knope is such a dope, you know? And it's like, okay, season two, let's revamp a little bit. Leslie Knope is an awesome woman who dates actually, like, attractive, cool guys. And yeah, her job is kind of funny, working at the Parks Department in Pawnee, Indiana, but her
coworkers
are funny.
But she gets shit done, and people respect what she does. And another reason why I like Parks and Rec is because the viewer is meant to empathize with Leslie. Like,
yeah.
And it's not like, you know, like The Office or 30 Rock, where I see similar scenarios play out, and then they're never questioned. It's never like, yeah, the hot one did win because she's hot. It's like here, you're like the viewer. Safer. Yeah, the viewer was supposed to realize, like, this was an unfair and sexist call. And that's why I like the show.
That's interesting to me. I like that.
Check it out, Chamonix. You won't be disappointed.
Done.
Same to you, listeners. All right. Well, let's move on to our bitch faves besides faving Parks and Rec. Chamonix, do you want to kick us off?
Yeah. Lately, for the last, I would say, 3 days, all I've been doing is watching episodes of Freaks and Geeks. I think it's quite interesting, especially watching the show a significant amount of years later, where now you can identify all these characters that have gone on to do other things and become more famous. So aside from John Francis Daly, who is my favorite on the show, who's now on Bones, which is a wonderful, wonderful show. There's Shia LaBeouf.
Is Shia LaBeouf on Freaks and Geeks?
He was. He was the original mascot who, like, hurt himself.
Oh.
Ah, yes. Also, Lizzie Kaplan plays some random girl who shows up every now and then doe-eyed. It's cute. And also, Joanna Garcia plays a very naive cheerleader. So it's nice to see people where they initially got their starts and now doing different things, albeit not as awesome as Freaks and Geeks.
It's a good show.
I have started actually reading from the very beginning of People's History of the United States, and I always knew it was out there, I knew what it stood for, but, like, actually reading it has been really helpful because you, like, really have a good idea, and I find, even though I'm only into the first three chapters, which is, like the horrific colonization of the Americas, the beginning of the slave trade, and then some, like, stuff about early settlements, who are, like, all... Like, everyone considers Australia, like, oh, yeah, that's where they sent all the convicts. But they did that in America, too. And it's just, like, really great that, knowing that, like, and reading it from the beginning, I find that it comes up in everyday conversation or instances, and I think back to it a lot. So I recommend making yourself sit down and read it. If you have to read it with a friend, do it. But I really enjoyed reading the late Howard Zinn's A People's History.
And I have to admit, that's another book that I've known was out there. I'm with you. Like, I've never actually sat down and read it. So, yeah. Good recommendation. I will recommend, I've been at least kind of loosely participating in the NCAA Top 64 bracket tournament. Although, I totally messed up my bracket, and I didn't pick any of the Final Four teams, so I'm out. But if you're in the same boat as me, there's an awesome website, or there's an awesome blog post on the website mentalfloss.com. That is a roundup of 8 other alternative bracket tournaments that you can get yourself involved in. And I found out about it because for the past few years, I have participated in Fug Madness on the Go Fug Yourself website, where you vote on celebrity outfits and who deserves the Fug Madness trophy for the year. But there's also a Muppet Madness bracket. There's a Pie versus Cake bracket on Jezebel. There's, like, a Best Sneaker bracket. There's the Weirdest Name of the Year bracket.
Shamani and me should go.
I know. Winners. I don't know. Tag team champs.
One of the people is named Coke. So it's like Coke O'Neill or something. So anyway, it's just a lot of fun, and it's kind of a fun alternative. If, like me, your bracket is busted, you can still vote on if you like Fraggle Rock or the Muppets more. So it's not too late. And that does it for today. Thanks so much for tuning in to this episode of Bitch Propaganda. And if you're interested in more of our audio offerings, please visit bitchmedia.org/audio. And have a great week.